Hello and welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner with you here on ABC Radio National. In Australia today, it seems that schools and education are contested ground. But perhaps this isn't a recent phenomenon. Society, quite rightly, has always had an opinion about what our children are taught. And the history of pedagogy itself, the method of teaching, makes for fascinating reading. These days, there's much public discussion about measurable outcomes in education, about how to reward schools, students and teachers for improving literacy and numeracy. Schools are ranked in order of their academic performance. There's talk of paying teachers according to the scores garnered in their students' reports and penalising them against the same benchmarks. Quietly navigating its way through all these playground battles is a humble but much loved school institution, one that survived for almost a century. The School Magazine began in 1916 as a free publication for primary school classes. Its aim was to give children the joy of reading good literature, great stories and tales, unfettered by the trappings of pedagogy. In this program, An Older Kind of Magic, Lorena Allam explores the history of the School Magazine.
The School Magazine of Literature for Our Boys and Girls. Part 1 for Class 3. Volume 1, Number 1, Sydney. February the 1st, 1916.
It has impressed me very much whenever I think about the School Magazine to realise that it was a very adventurous and daring experiment on the part of the Education Department.
How fast you are growing up. Only a short time ago you began to go to school, and now you are starting in your third class.
It first appeared during the First World War, in days of hardship, anxiety, and someone had the bright idea that the children should have a magazine of their own. It began as a very small magazine. It grew over the years.
Do you remember your first day at school? What a strange building the schoolhouse was. And you had never seen so many children together as you found gathered about the school building that first day.
It has never gone out of print since. Even in the days of the Depression, when the magazine was reduced to a quarter of its size because of printing costs and paper shortages, the magazine always appeared.
Do you remember how strange those little black marks in the book looked? Those little black marks that the teacher called words? You wondered how the older girls and boys that you heard reading got such interesting stories from those little black marks.
The real heart of the history is that the role that it played in bringing generation after generation of writers to generation after generation of children.
Kids, come and sit down here in front of the seat, please.
I love the fact that it's a really pure and beautiful thing insofar that it has no advertising, it has no agenda or purpose other than to delight children and introduce them to the joys of reading.
But the thing about the school magazine was that you could have your very own one and you were allowed to read it and allowed to travel off into your imagination during school.
And the smell of it. It used to smell really strong coming down the neat rows of desks. It was exciting as it got closer and closer because, you know, it was simple times, simple pleasures. Oh, and the binders. You used to be able to bind binders at the news agency and bind them up, yeah.
Going to a state school, I can't remember there being any library in the school, and so it was quite exciting to get something like the school magazine, and the pictures were always just in black and white, but we were allowed to cover them in with pencil.
I read it when I was in primary school and absolutely loved it. I read it in the 1980s when Pamela Allen was illustrating it, and I've got some copies at home in their special little folder, and yeah, I really treasure them.
A love of words would be instilled. On the other hand, I remember one woman who was working somewhere else in the department came to our little corner one day and said, I just have to tell you how important the school magazine has been to me. I used to read your stories about witches, and that's what made me a witch today. So who knows what its legacy is? Its legacy is manifold.
What a delightful place is Storyland. And here is your own magazine to lead you farther into this fairyland, where even stranger things will happen and more wonderful people be seen.
In 1916, the New South Wales Department of Education had a great idea. It would produce an edifying literary magazine for primary school children, available free each month, which would uphold the values of nation and empire and give children good moral instruction. The school magazine was born, and with it, a 94-year tradition of Australian writers producing good literature for Australian children. Throughout its history, the school magazine has been edited by a who's who of Australian literature. Patricia Wrightson, Lilith Norman, Noreen Shelley, Duncan Ball, and more recently, Kath Hawke, Anna Feinberg and Toby Riddle, among others. The magazine is a big reason why children's literature in Australia is so successful. It enabled many of them to make a living, however meagre, from writing and illustrating for children. But the school magazine has not had an easy time of it. It's always been a shoestring operation, driven by some strong personalities and their passion for literature. And in its long life, it has incurred the wrath of governments, schools, parents, and the media. Noreen Shelley spent a decade as editor in the 1960s before leaving to become a full-time writer. Listeners of a certain age might remember her most famous creation, Little Piggy Grunter. In 1975, about 5 years after her retirement, Noreen Shelley recalled what would happen if the school magazine made a mistake.
We liked to pride ourselves that we never failed in our part, so it was a shock when the government printer rang me up one day to inform me that we had spelt the word kangaroo incorrectly in the heading of a story and that one of the printers had picked this up. Too late to do anything about it, because the next day there were letters to the Herald and letters to all the other papers complaining about the school magazine, saying that no wonder businessmen complain that their typists can't spell if this is the spelling that's used in the school magazine. Now, how that happened, I'll never know, because every member of the staff read the proofs not once but twice before the magazine appeared, and yet we had all missed the fact that we'd spelt kangaroo K-A-N-G-E-R-O-O.
There were kind of moments when it comes under public scrutiny, trivial things like once the crossword said the clue was the capital of Sweden and the answer was Oslo, which is incorrect. That got questions asked in Parliament.
That's Jonathan Shaw. Jonathan was editor of the school magazine for about 15 years. We're sitting in his Sydney home going through old documents about the magazine. Jonathan has a theory about the magazine's survival in the face of bureaucracy and controversy. He thinks its survival is due to a handful of outspoken, fiery women.
I inherited the philosophy that really had been ushered in by Noreen Shelley in the 60s, that it was a magazine for the individual child, that when the magazine arrived at the school, it was something that the child would welcome and could have as their own and take home and enjoy. So we aimed to make it a literary experience so that it was something, from our point of view, although we knew it was going to be important for classroom use, it was a text that was there to be read for itself. And so any kind of classroom use would build on the literary experience. So really we aimed to please.
To please the children,
yeah.
First of all.
Yeah, yeah.
You said to me earlier that you thought the history of the magazine was highlighted by a lot of very stroppy women defending passionately a particular approach to books and writing, or writing and publishing. Is that true, do you think?
I think that is true. I don't know a lot about Doris Chadwick, but the fact that she was, I think she was there from the beginning in 1916 until the early 50s, she was a formidable person. Some of the older artists tell the story of when they first met her, they were required to wear gloves and to curtsy. She was deaf as a post, so you had to curtsy and shout when you were ushered into the presence. Noreen Shelley, she published a number of books, which sadly aren't around anymore, but she kind of had a devotion to the kind of ancient myth. So she wrote a number of books retelling those, and she was passionate about art. She had studied art school, and it was she who really brought the illustration to the fore.
Noreen Shelley recalls some of her achievements as editor.
The first and perhaps the most important one was the introduction of a new format for the magazine, so that instead of appearing in one type for children of different ages in the primary school, we published it in four different grades, one for each grade, and each particular grade had its own type, its own layout, its own presentation. And I was always very much interested in the work of the illustrators of the magazine, because there was a time when I thought I might be an artist instead of a writer. And I went to the Sydney Art School in my youth, but decided after a while that I really preferred writing. But I had studied enough art to be able to understand the attitude and the problems of artists, and made many good friends during those years at the magazine, particularly among the artists who illustrated for me.
While Noreen Shelley was editor, a young art student, Nola Young, began drawing for the magazine. Nola Young's beautifully detailed pictures of animals and children are so much a part of the childhoods of many of us. Anyone who's read Ruth Park's Muddle-Headed Wombat will know it's Nola's drawings that brought him to life. 53 years after submitting her first drawings for Noreen Shelley, Nola Young still illustrates for the magazine.
Well, in the early days, it was very difficult to earn a living as a book illustrator because there weren't very many books being published in the 50s and 60s. And the rather meagre earnings from school magazines certainly helped with the budget. But, I mean, I also did commercial work as commercial artist as well. And book illustration tended to be, it was an interest and it was something that I loved, whereas I probably could have made a much better living as a commercial artist or in advertising, but I've always been really interested in children's stories and in the illustrations.
The school magazine's been described to me as something of a cultural institution, yet it seems to live quietly. It isn't celebrated probably as much as it should be. Why is it so unassuming, do you think?
Maybe it was because in the early years the magazine was free, and the people who were enjoying it were children. Though I'm sure later on, when they became adults, they looked back on their experience with the school magazine with a great deal of pleasure. I mean, it just went along quietly because, you know, the people who were enjoying it didn't have a loud voice, I suppose. In my experience, the people who worked in the editorial side of the school magazine have always been dedicated, passionate people interested in children's literature. And it's been one of the great benefits of being able to work with people like that, because they haven't been just commercially minded, they've been people that you can share that sort of passion to try and do the best, to give children the best that you can.
artist Nola Young, who began her career illustrating for the school magazine under the editorship of Noreen Shelley. In her time, Noreen Shelley made sure the school magazine was available to every child.
I mentioned earlier that the magazine is now printed in a blown-up form, a certain number for the partially sighted children in the schools, and each month, each issue is printed in Braille. And I remember very well the first day the first issue came out. It was a great event, not just for the editorial staff, but for the education department. And in our office in the education building in Sydney, we had photographers and reporters from all the newspapers and magazines. We had some blind children. We had one of our artists there drawing. And the Sydney Morning Herald the next Saturday had the most beautiful photograph of this blind boy reading his magazine for the first time with his fingers. And the expression on his face was unforgettable.
During the early years of the school magazine, the Department of Education saw it as a means of giving children moral instruction. Nationalism and good values were important, as was an appreciation of the official history and national character. Noreen Shelley was not afraid to use the magazine to support causes she found important, big or small.
Another thing that gives me a lot of pleasure even now is to be out on a wet day and see the number of children getting around in their yellow raincoats, because the school magazine helped to introduce this fashion for yellow raincoats. The health department came to me and told me that they'd been making tests and they had learnt that yellow, a bright clear yellow, was the best colour for visibility in grey and rainy weather, and they were trying to encourage children to wear yellow raincoats. So we got one of our writers to write a special story about a boy and his yellow raincoat. That was in the magazine, and it was reprinted on different occasions later. And it fascinates me now when I'm out in the street in wet weather anywhere in New South Wales to see that nearly every child's raincoat is a yellow one.
Noreen Shelley speaking with Hazel de Burgh in 1975. When she left to write full-time, her job was assumed by another formidable woman, the award-winning novelist Patricia Wrightson. Ms. Wrightson passed away earlier this year, leaving a great legacy to Australian children. In novels like The Nagan and the Stars, Patricia Wrightson used Aboriginal spirits to try to create an Australian mythology. Ms. Wrightson received the Hans Christian Andersen Medal in 1984 for her contribution to children's literature. And as an editor, she was a force to be reckoned with, says Jonathan Shaw.
Patricia Wrightson, well, when someone objected to the phrase, wipe your bottom, she wrote back saying, you haven't explained what is objectionable about the bottom. Would you have objected to wipe your nose? Like, she was kind of not going to take nonsense from anyone.
Dear Mr. Stewart, thank you for your letter of July the 11th regarding the phrase, wipe your bottom, in the June issue of the school magazine. I am sorry you found this homely phrase objectionable. It must be pointless to indicate that it was written by one of our leading poets and writers who is now chairman of the Literature Board, or to ask whether smack your bottom or wipe your nose would have been as offensive, or to ask for a clear explanation of what is offensive in the phrase. I can only say that we cannot possibly undertake not to be offensive. We continually offend. We offend by failing to keep in touch with the fast-moving world of young readers and by being too contemporary, by a rigid adherence to syntax and formal style, and by our disregard of them. Our verse is both too classic and too unclassic. We offend by speaking with respect of the church and the theory of evolution, the plight of captive nations and the achievements of communist countries, Anzac Day and the laws relating to Aborigines. We can only follow our usual policy of holding a balance between these things while still aiming for honesty and life. As to your use of the school magazine in the future, this is always a matter for your decision. Withholding the magazine from children is another matter. It is produced for the children, and those who wish to read it are entitled to receive it. Yours faithfully, Mrs. Patricia Wrightson, editor, School Magazine, 30th July, 1974.
One of the constant things in the magazine is people will write objecting to what they see as incorrect grammatical use, or people of a certain religious background will object to things that are against their religious backgrounds. So in my time, we ran a cartoon that was set in India that had images of an Indian goddess. And one school principal was irate at that. His argument was that it contravened the departmental policy of secularity, that we shouldn't have images of gods in the classroom. But basically, he didn't want the children to be given images of non-Christian gods. When people spoke like that to me, I was placatory, listened to them at length, explained our point of view. When they wrote like that to Patricia Wrightson, she wrote back scathingly, telling them basically that they had no right to impose their views on the rest of the world, and she took no prisoners.
Dear Mr. and Mrs. Burgess, since you are concerned and thinking people, I will not offer you a politically smooth reply, but give you explanations which I know you will consider with fairness. I admire your objective in training your children. For my own, I would add, to recognise and understand their own problems and those of others, so that they may act effectively. The best modern children's novels are deeply concerned with arousing this understanding, as the best novels always were. You will remember that the novelist Charles Dickens was a powerful force in awakening the society of his day to many of the social evils that existed then. Ignorant nurses who preyed on the sick, ignorant schoolmasters who ill-treated children abandoned to their care, employers of children who took advantage of them, and so on. He did not achieve social awareness by whitewashing the syntax of his villains or his victims. He did it by showing them alive, evil or agonized. He is only one of the body of serious and sincere novelists. In the school magazine, we draw on no other kind. I do not believe that your minister of religion, if he gave a fair reading to the stories of which you write, a dog called Wig and a pair of Jesus boots, and our articles introducing them, would feel anything but satisfaction that children's literature is so seriously presenting the problems of children for their thinking concern. Yours sincerely, Mrs. Patricia Wrightson, editor, The School Magazine, November 1972.
When people wrote and said that they disapproved of the way the magazine was using phrases like starting sentences with and but, she wrote back and said, "Find me a writer in the English language who is esteemed who hasn't done that. You know, this is a convenient thing for teachers in the classroom. It is not how the language works."
Jonathan Shaw. For several years, Patricia Wrightson's deputy was the novelist Lilith Norman, who took over as editor when Ms. Wrightson retired in 1975. Lilith Norman once wrote of her time as editor, "I learned more during the 5 years Patricia Wrightson was editor at the school magazine than I would have in 50 years of fumbling on my own. I learned to stick glue on the seat of my pants and sit down and write, the hardest discipline of all." It may have been a good thing that Norman learned the art of perseverance. In 1977, she had to defend the magazine against the media and the parliament, all because of a little story written for senior primary school children. In a regular column called You Be the Judge, the magazine presented current affairs to older children. The column was designed to give readers as wide a range of views as possible. This time the column was about legal and illegal drugs.
There was an article about drugs that said something about some people think that marijuana may be no more harmful than alcohol, and there was a huge storm about that. The entire issue of the magazine was pulped. the two people who were on staff at the time, editorial people, were suspended from duty and major furore.
Daily Telegraph, 15th of March, 1977. Rebuke for drug article. The editor of a school magazine which carried a controversial article about drugs has been reprimanded, the Minister for Education, Mr. Bedford, said last night. He said the editor, Mrs. L. Norman, had agreed the article was not consistent with the magazine's aims.
In arguing for her reinstatement, Lilith Norman wrote to the Department of Education and mounted a dignified defence of the magazine.
The aim of the articles is to present, as objectively as possible, both sides of contemporary topics. Mrs. Wrightson was very aware that too often only one side is presented in the media and by interested parties, and that children are entitled to receive fairer information than that. This approach has received warm approval as being in line with the current move to make education more participatory. As far as the article itself is concerned, I believe that the present furore is largely due to unfortunate coincidence, in that it appeared at a time when the subject of drugs was politically hot. It has been fanned by the most vicious misquotations and juxtapositions published in the press. Even so, I am appalled and bewildered by the vindictiveness of the reaction. It is unreal. School magazine has always dealt with controversial and emotive issues. Aborigines, conservation and so on, long before the present series of articles was started. And it has always dealt with them fairly. It seems to me that to present a picture of what is happening in society, and which is of deep concern to society, and then to question whether this is in fact a good thing, which in my opinion the article as a whole does, is the only fair presentation. School magazine has been accused of being out of touch with contemporary life. It seems to me that any journal which is accused of being too conservative and now, for almost the first time, of being too frank, must, given the pluralistic nature of Australian society, be successful in following its policy of adhering to the middle of the road. Miss Horniman and I, indeed all of the staff, are extremely sensitive to the fact that school magazine goes to all children, that is, to a widely divergent population holding widely divergent views. We have always scrupulously maintained that it must never be an organ for sectional, political, or one-sided views, nor a mouthpiece for our own personal opinions. While I am editor, it never will be. Lilith Norman, March 1977.
Lilith Norman had her quiet supporters within the department. One of them wrote to her in the midst of the drama.
The editor, school magazine. May I just say, with what enjoyment I read the statement you recently had circulated to all the inspectors and administrators. I sympathised with the tone of stout assertion in the face of endless, often mindless, sniping and griping. May your shoulders remain broad and your teeth sharp. Yours faithfully.
Bruce, your note arrived just as I was finishing yet another article about school magazine. This time from the practical side. Why we can't use today's headlines since we go to press about 5 months ahead, etc. My fangs grew another 3 inches and became self-sharpening, and my shoulders now rival those of Atlas. Thank you. L. Norman, March 1977.
Sydney Morning Herald. School drugs author back in job under close supervision. The author of a school magazine article urging sixth-class children to make up their own minds about drugs is back at her old job, but under close supervision. The New South Wales Minister of Education, Mr. Bedford, said yesterday that his department would be revisiting some of its publication procedures. The editor of the magazine, Mrs. L. Norman, had been reprimanded over the incident, but is also back at her job.
Kath Hawke, who was editor when I first worked at the magazine, at that time there was a story that had been illustrated in the manner, an excerpt from a book that had been illustrated in the manner of the person who had illustrated the book. And the publisher, who was an English publisher, wrote saying that this was breach of copyright. Where I would have written back and said, I'm so sorry that you've taken it that way, but blah, blah, blah. She wrote back and said, you obviously have no understanding of what it takes to write it, to publish a magazine. None of the illustrations in the book fitted our needs. We wanted to convey the sense of the book, and so we had to do an illustration of our own. We acknowledged that it was in the manner of. We didn't pretend it was actually by your illustrator. And while I'm at it, isn't it about time that your government had the kind of guts and the nous to produce a magazine of the quality that New South Wales has been producing now for 80 years? And that letter went off. Yeah, so...
Stroppy women.
Stroppy women, that's right. Long may they reign.
You're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. I'm Lorena Allam, and today's program is called An Older Kind of Magic, and it's a history of the school magazine.
I'm Anna Feenberg. I'm a children's writer, largely. I write across a range of age groups, children's, young adult readers, adult books now too. And I worked at School Magazine for 10 years, from 1980 to 1990.
What drew you to working there in the first place?
Well, I saw the advertisement in the newspaper and in the Sydney Morning Herald, and I couldn't believe it because I had loved that magazine as a child. And here was, it was like my dream job, if it was possible, as editorial assistant at the school magazine in the city. And I applied for it. I mean, really, for a reader, it was a dream job. You know, I loved the people I worked with too. They were all like-minded, four of us who just loved to be immersed in stories. And so, you know, most of the morning you could be reading about Wicked Witch or pirates that were playing up, and then, oh, it's lunchtime. Of course, it wasn't all like that, and there were administrative and downsides, but it was a dream job in that way.
You've also said that your mum was a reader of the school magazine. So is that right, that you were...
Yes.
This is second generation now?
Yes, it is. This is this lovely thing about its history. She has told me about having that same experience with the magazine, and that I think it caused quite a bit of trouble for her because she would tend to read it under her desk. I don't know in those days whether you were allowed to drop everything and read. She would get lost in a story and then, of course, miss entire lessons and get into trouble. But she had a very vivid imagination, and she started telling stories by retelling stories she'd read in the magazine or heard on the ABC, on the radio. Mm.
Anna Feenberg and her mother Barbara are the authors of the successful and much-loved Tashie series, stories about a small magical boy from a far-off land who encounters mythical creatures and all kinds of villains. Anna says working at the magazine turned her into a writer for children.
You know, as editorial assistants and editors and so on, we also needed to write articles each month. There's a non-fiction article, and so we would research and write them. But sometimes there weren't enough stories, serials, or plays, and so the editors felt we had to do that and do it quickly and to a deadline. Very good training. Mm. And so I wrote quite a few stories and discovered that it came quite easily, and I really enjoyed it. But I think it was Kath Hawke who she saw them and said, you know, you've got to collect these, put these into a book, and you've got to start writing, you know. And she was very encouraging about it. And in fact, so because she said I had to, I did that, and my publishing career sort of took off then. So I think there were a lot of ingredients. There was my love of reading and writing. There was Kath encouraging me, and that sense of the presence of these wonderful editors, you know, historically.
Mm. Anna Feenberg. Those wonderful editors didn't work for everyone. Cassandra Golds is a writer for young adults who grew up in the 1970s loving stories of fantasy and magic, and those fanciful worlds weren't much represented in the school magazine of her childhood. Cassandra says it turned her into something of a school magazine rebel.
When I was growing up as a primary school student, you really had to look overseas for that kind of writing. Even though we had Patricia Wrightson, who was somewhat metaphysical, still there was an emphasis in the 70s when I was a primary school student on the very Australian, the very here and now. In a way, the bulletin 1890s tradition of Australian bushfires, the country. And if it was suburban, it was very ordinary suburban. So less of the metaphysics and less of the fantasy, perhaps.
It's interesting that you gravitated towards that. You kind of rejected that tradition in a way and wanted something more magical.
Yes, I did. I was something of a, not so much an angry as an opinionated child, I suppose, and I was inclined to rebel against anything that I felt was imposed on us. And as I said, I suppose the main thing I remember about it was feeling a sense of rebelliousness about it, because it never seemed to have in it what I wanted to read. And also perhaps that there was a certain tone in it that I rebelled against as a primary school child, a certain strength of tone, which is not bad in itself, but I suppose because it was less charming and less, it wasn't trying to win you over. It was just being itself and like it or lump it, which there's a fair argument for, I guess, but I suppose I tended to be irritated by that. The women in charge of it were very strong personalities indeed. Lilith Norman and Patricia Wrightson were the editors at the time. And they had very strong voices, and they made me want to argue with them.
They might have liked that.
They might have. And actually, I was talking about this to Jonathan Shaw the other day, and he was pointing out to me that, of course, part of the function of that, in a way, perhaps surprisingly, is that it obviously helps to develop a child's taste. And so my taste, in some ways, was developed as a kind of an argument against Lilith Norman and Patricia Wrightson.
The establishment.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Despite that, Cassandra Golds began working there as a young writer, having just published her first novel under the guidance of Jennifer Rowe, who thousands of Australian children will know as Emily Rodder.
My book came out in 1985, and a job came up a bit later that year, and so I went for an interview and got it. It was temporary at first and became permanent.
And how long were you there for altogether?
I think about 17 years. So it was actually my apart from writing manuscripts and having some things accepted, it was my first full-time job. And, my last full-time job, actually, because I left to become a freelance writer.
Do you think that you could have had that opportunity to write had you not been working there?
Well, the short answer is no. I'd say no for sure. And that's I suppose, the beauty of collaboration with like minds, with people who are very simpatico. But also I just think, I suppose I can't really think of any other place where you would get that kind of opportunity.
Cassandra Gold says she's noticed a generational change in Australian writing for children, partly a rebellion against the realist tradition, and partly a sign that we're more outward-looking these days.
I think perhaps we've matured enough not to feel it necessary to emphasise our Australianness at every possible opportunity. And so I think that to somehow feel that because you're an Australian writer, you must keep entirely to a very narrow idea of what Australian subjects are is the way to kill people's spirit.
Or make them rebels.
You all make them into rebels, it's true.
Oh, where do you start? It was a very warm and inclusive environment, particularly in the old...
Stephen Axelson. He's a much-loved and prolific children's illustrator. He's contributed to the magazine since 1985.
It was almost like having a family in a way.
Can you describe yourself?
About 5 foot seven. I used to be 5 foot eight. I've lost 10 kilos recently, and I'm very proud of that. I'm a wizened little old man that started illustrating in 1973.
Started illustrating for your own pleasure or for
no,
money?
I thought I might be able to make a living out of it, yes. I started with children's books and stayed with children's books ever since.
Mm-hmm. What is it about children's books that you like so much?
I think it's something about arrested development in my childhood. Yes, I didn't have a lot of fun as a child, so I'm just making up for lost time. And that's serious.
The school magazine you've illustrated for a long time, how many years have you had an association?
I started there in 1985, just before we moved to Byronshire, actually. They liked me and I liked them. It was wonderful. And it was because it was so ongoing, it developed into a very tight relationship. As a freelancer, your publishers tend to come and go. Your favourite editors change publishing houses. But this was one stable element through my career.
Many have said that was the thing that was attractive, that was the stability, that you could count on it as a kind of income while you were working on other things to do with children.
Yeah, financially it was a blessing, a real boon, because I could use that as a core of my income and then diverge from that. Without that, it would have been an even rattier career than it's been.
Do you think then that the school magazines made a contribution to children's literature in that way, that it's given people a chance to earn a crust while they are writing those great
novels?
Well,
from an illustrator's perspective, I'd think so, because it's meant that a number of us have been able to specialise where we may not have been able to otherwise. And I think through that specialisation, your skills develop and you're able to contribute more, as opposed to doing a bit of illustration, a bit of teaching, a bit of advertising work and that sort of thing. It's a theory, but I'm sticking to it.
These days, the school magazine is still in print, but it's not free to every school child anymore. Since the mid-1990s, the magazine has been available only on subscription. Schools have to find the money to subscribe, and consequently there's pressure on the magazine to stay relevant to the changing classroom. Alan Edwards is the school magazine's current editor.
You know, the world's changed in a lot of ways, so these days there are a lot of economic considerations that didn't have to be taken into account in the past. In 1993, I think it was, the decision was made to make the magazine revenue funded, so we had to pay our own way. And at that point, the free magazine stopped to schools. But there definitely is a challenge to remain relevant, because schools, you know, particularly public schools these days, have limited budgets, and when we're competing against all sorts of other needs that they have, they're putting money into smart boards, computer hardware, software. So we're just one of a number of expenses that a school might have. So we need to convince them that we're relevant for their needs. So over the last couple of years, we've introduced teaching units, which go out in conjunction with the school magazine, and they're tailored to the curriculum, and they have four teaching sessions in each one. So we've been trying to get the word out to teachers that there's this great resource there. And of course, the Australian curriculum is going to be introduced over the next couple of years. It starts to be phased in next year, fully underway by 2012. So we see that as a great opportunity for the school magazine to market ourselves across Australia. We currently have subscription schools that subscribe to us in every state and territory of Australia. But I see an even greater opportunity there to be more relevant than ever to a wider audience than ever.
Do you think there's still room for a magazine that's just for kids, that's just for the joy of reading, in a school context?
Oh, absolutely. And the, as I say, the letters and the emails from the kids convey to us just how much they love the magazine.
Sue Murray, Karen Jameson and Emma Hyde are three quarters of the magazine's current editorial staff. Despite the pressures to stay relevant, they proudly uphold the long traditions of the magazine. I asked them why they still take manuscripts when nearly every publishing house in Australia turns them down.
Oh, because you never know what's going to be found in the inbox. It's really, I think, one of the great strengths of the school magazine is that we open to all writers. And I know that we've launched the careers of some of Australia's best children's writers. And I think it's important that people have a way of starting in this world.
It also means that we get a huge diversity of voices. We don't just get famous, well-established writers. We get people who are writing for the first time, people who've waited for this moment in their life to finally put pen to paper, and we get things that are really from the heart.
We also get writers from all around the world. Actually, we have submissions from lots of different countries and from all over Australia, which is fun to see all kinds of backgrounds and ages and, yeah.
What are some of the things that you love about working here?
I actually think one of the best things about a magazine is you can have traditional work and you can have the best of the new. So we recently published the lyrics of Click Go This Year's because we thought some children might not realise that, you know, that's part of our wonderful world of words. But it's also exciting to be working with a graphic designer that, like we have, who wants to come up with new ways of presenting the material. So, yeah, I think it's good to be open to new but to respect the old.
I think it's a matter of maintaining the value and integrity that the magazine was launched with back in 1916, but keeping it alive and fresh in today's market.
You've been a mainstay, a source of income for so many children's illustrators and writers in Australia. Do you take some credit for how healthy the children's literature scene is in this country?
I don't know that we lift our heads up too high to think beyond how excited we are by the next issue we're putting out. Occasionally when we have things like the annual lunch where we invite the illustrators in, we do look around the room and think how amazing that we have such rich talent working with us. But I don't know that we actually sit back and think, gee, we're nurturing the profession. We work best if we don't think big picture about what the magazine is to anyone else except the readers. And I think it's important that we stay true to that vision. It is wonderful when we get the bound volume for a year and look back and think how amazing look at the product we've produced. But because we're sending out 32-page booklets to different children in month after month, we don't tend to have the time to get that perspective, and I think it's good not to.
For over 90 years, the school magazine has fostered generations of writers, illustrators and readers, all of whom care deeply about these offerings to our children. It's been quietly going about its business without fanfare, but its influence has been immeasurable.
In fact, it stays in people's minds for the rest of their lives. When I was editor, we would regularly have queries from people in their 80s saying, I remember a poem that I read in the school magazine when I was such and such a time. You know, so it sort of, it functions as a major influence on the culture without being acknowledged as such.
I think there's always a place for the school magazine in the sense that this deluge of media input for kids available these days, but I like to imagine that the school magazine in the context of the school is a nice oasis of peace in amongst everything else.
I doubt that reading can, or literature can, do everything it can do unless it's being read for pleasure and unless it's being read voluntarily, because that's the only way it can have a chance of expanding people's spirits and developing their personalities even and their opinions and their compassion for other people. And it has to happen naturally and through pleasure and through personal choice.
Rather than now we will teach you about the world, which is important and necessary, and it's an adult responsibility to children, we also have responsibility to say we're in this together. And I think that was sort of what underlay my sense of what the magazine ought to be saying to the children.
There was a great quote by E.B. White, that the well-known children's author who wrote Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little. And E.B. White was once asked if there was any shifting of gears in writing books for children, and he said anybody who shifts gears when he writes for children is likely to wind up stripping his gears. Anyone who writes down to children is simply wasting his time. You have to write up, not down. Children are demanding. They are the most attentive, curious, eager, observant, sensitive, quick, and generally congenial readers on earth. They accept, almost without question, anything you present them with, as long as it is presented honestly, fearlessly, and clearly. And to me, that summarises exactly what we look for in stories.
An Older Kind of Magic was produced for Hindsight by Lorena Allam, with technical production from Mark Don. With thanks to Anna Feinberg, Jonathan Shaw, Nola Young, Cassandra Golds, Alan Edwards, and all the staff and supporters of The School magazine. We'd also like to thank the National Library of Australia for permission to reproduce the interview with Noreen Shelley. And thanks as well to ABC archivist John Spence. Readings were by Jane Harders, Jennifer Hagen, Jane Ullman and David Baldwin. And if you've got a memory of the school magazine, then we'd love to hear from you. You may have cherished your weekly dose of reading offered by the magazine above all else at school, or you may have shoved the magazine right down the bottom of your school bag, unread and unloved. Whatever the hue of your memory of the school magazine, do send it in. You can post a comment on our webpage, where you can also browse the image gallery and hear this program again as streamed audio or download as a podcast. Go to abc.net.au/rn/hindsight.
Come all you workers and hear what I say. They're trying to run down the 8-hour day, won by our forebears in a bloody campaign. So rise up and be in the struggle again. So stand up united, let no one betray our right and our children's theatre.
And next week, we kick off a two-part series which explores one of the foundation stories in Australia's labour history. It's surely an historical irony that 21st century Australia clocks up some of the longest working hours in the OECD, when it was second only to New Zealand in achieving the 8-hour working day.
A young man left his native shores. The trade was bad at home. To seek his fortune in this land, he crossed the briny foam. And when he went to Ballarat, it bore...
The 8-hour day is, like so many other things, a product of the discovery of gold and that extraordinary transformation of Eastern Australian society in the decade following 1851.
On the 5th of the month, a conference of the Masons delegates was held at the St Lawrence Hotel Fitzroy, where the following resolutions were passed. That it is the opinion of this meeting that a reduction of the hours of labour would be greatly beneficial to the trade and also tend to improve our social and moral condition. Second, to carry the foregoing resolution into effect, it is indispensably necessary that we be in a perfectly organised condition.
We've looked at the site where workers down tools at the University of Melbourne. Now, they moved through the city to all building sites on the 21st of April, 1856. It wasn't so much a strike in the traditional sense of declaring a dispute. It was to celebrate a negotiated settlement of a claim. And workers, as they passed by this very spot, down tools on the site and joined them. This was by prior arrangement.
So stand up united, let no one betray our right and our children's the 8-hour day.
The rise and fall of 888, next week on Hindsight.